Welcome to Afterwards, Manhattan Theater Club's discussion series at the Biltmore. My name is Lisa McNulty. I'm the Associate Director of Artistic Operations here at MTC. And I'm very fortunate to have three amazing folks to talk to you today about Top Girls. First of all, on my right, I have Alisa Solomon, who is a noted journalist and critic and director of the Arts and Culture Concentration at Columbia University School of Journalism, who's written often on Carol Churchill and her work. There's actually no way I could do full justice to Alisa's accomplishments here and still have time to talk about the play, so I would urge you to look in your program, where you have a nice stuffer that tells you all kinds of interesting things about her and things she's done. Our other guests are the wonderful Jennifer Ikeda and Mary Catherine Garrison, who played some of the sort of host of characters you've seen today. They've got big wigs and costumes and things to struggle out of, so they'll be joining us as soon as they're ready. To the play. You've returned often to Carol Churchill's work in your writing and scholarship. I'd love to start by talking about her as a writer. You said about her plays that they challenge our most basic assumptions, they fascinate and entertain, and their challenges are sneaky. I would say that all of these statements are true of Top Girls. Where do you find the sneaky challenges, both in this play and in her work in general? I know it's a big question.
Yeah. It's a huge question.
I know, sorry.
And I'm still digesting, you know, the experience that we all just had. I guess I'd say that the challenges are sneaky in the range of her work, first and foremost because she's always unpredictable.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people here have watched her work over the last 30 years. This play is about 25 years old, and there have been quite a few more that have played in New York. You never know what to expect formally. She invents the form for the play based on the themes and the characters that she's dealing with. So in this play, we have the three distinct acts that have different that exist in different time zones. And while she's played with the question of temporality in other plays, never like this.
Right.
And so I guess the first thing I'd say is that there's always something that's a little sneaky and challenging about entering the work formally. You know, there are things that are familiar in a family situation that seems kind of naturalistic, and things at the same time that are fantastical and historical and political, and and the way they overlap and intersect and comment on each other is always a little sneaky.
Well, I'm and here we have our ladies. Hooray! Mary Catherine Garrison and Jennifer Ikeda, thanks you guys for being with us. We were just talking about the way that Carol Churchill's work is a little sneaky, and I think I was going to start talking about that first scene, which I think is incredibly sneaky in the way that it plays with time and our perceptions about what you know reality is, where we are, and it just seems like an interesting place to start off the play. I'm curious, when you guys hopped into rehearsal, what your notions about that first scene were, what the approach in the room was. Did you guys do a lot of research to play these ladies?
Can you hear me okay like this?
Yeah.
Okay, I prefer not to use the microphone. Well, I know that when I first read the play... You can't, so you need the microphone. Okay. I know that when I first read the play, and if you were in theater school and you were female, you read the play, because it's all women, I never really understood that first scene, and I went into rehearsals still not understanding it. It's confounding, the overlapping. I'd never heard of any of those particular characters before, and I researched my character. And I sort of waited till rehearsal to hear about the others, which is very curious and very interesting. And we basically spent, I would say the majority of our rehearsal time was spent deciphering and decoding, so to speak, this scene. It warranted a lot of table time and discussion.
Yeah.
And it still is, I feel like today we actually took another little leap forward in terms of understanding it. And there's the rhythms. I mean, we talk about it a lot. It's like a piece of music that you sort of have to dive into and let it take you in and out. And there's rhythms and there's things you have to hit. And we're still sort of trying to find it. And I think, you know, sometimes we're better than others, but it's a team effort, the scene, for sure. If you want to add anything to that.
Sure. I did a ton of reading and watching films. The character that I play actually did exist, Lady Nijo, and she wrote her memoirs at the end of her life, which is actually a really fascinating book. And you can get a lot of information, you know, about her life and everything. And I watched a lot of old films, Japanese films, and but then I had to sort of throw a lot of that away because there are a lot of conventions in the play that just really aren't appropriate for Japanese culture in terms of, like, a Japanese person would never, in my opinion, interrupt someone else while they were speaking or speak over someone else. So, you know, it was interesting to try to balance all of those, you know, cultural things that I picked up with the play.
I love the level of character detail that you ladies are able to find in that first scene. I love you eating with your two knives as though they're chopsticks.
But, and I love the way you pour the wine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that an exciting thing also about that first scene is that it establishes so many of the themes that happen later in the play. You know, there's always that notion of if you could invite X many historical figures to dinner, who would you invite? I think it's very telling who Marlene chooses to invite. For you guys, I mean, were you consciously pulling out themes that occur later in the play? Do you feel like that's something that's... because I do feel like sometimes that scene is confounding for people. I'm curious both, you know, what you guys were discovering as actors and how that helped you in the second half of the scene, and also in terms of the scholarship of the play, how that first scene seats into the rest of Carol Churchill's work. So,
well, I mean, I noticed a lot of the recurring themes, mm-hmm. but when it comes down to it, I try not to play any of those
right.
when we're on stage. And I actually started to feel, the more that we were rehearsing it, that the more that you underplay those things mm-hmm. and sort of don't give them a lot of weight in the moment, the more that they stay with an audience afterwards. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is the kind of play where you have to stay one step ahead of the audience all the time, and that's why... A lot of times you can hear half of the audience laughing at something that went on this side of the stage, and the other half is sort of listening to what's going on this side. Because it's that balance of, you know, you want to present that theme but not hit anyone over the head with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm curious, the notion of, you know, what we learn about Marlene because of who she chooses to have at dinner. I mean, I think the interesting, Carol Churchill's a, you know, writer who identifies herself as a feminist, and I think that first scene with those women who've made very singular decisions about what they do with their, you know, made unusual or unorthodox decisions about what they do with their lives, reflects back on you know, Marlene's own choices. I'm curious, I'd just love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, that scene and how that informs the rest of the play. I got a big question. I keep asking you big unanswerable questions.
Well, let me try a few angles. The first thing I'd say is try to imagine the play without the first scene. Like if you had just walked in here into the second scene and the third scene, what framework would be missing, what things have been introduced, you know, what spores have been let loose into the atmosphere that maybe are taking on, you know, letting things rise, mm-hmm. I guess, in the second and third scenes. If it weren't there, I think we'd have a far less rich experience, and that might be one way to get a handle on it. But I think... more specifically, some of the important things that happen in that scene are, first of all, I think the extreme action, how extreme the choices are that each of those women has made, mm-hmm. and how binary the options are for them, mm-hmm. and what enormous lack of solidarity there is among them too, and that I think, you know, part of the overlapping speech reflects some of that they're all really absorbed and obsessed with their own narratives. And
if I may interrupt you, Carol Churchill style.
please do.
Just real quick, because one of the things that's interesting about that scene is that you're talking about a group of women who were largely without peers in their time, and so mm-hmm. it's the first time that they've actually had a table of other people on the same page, someone as them.
That's true. No, that's a really good point. I think at the same time that though that Churchill very much calls herself, you know, uses the F word and calls herself a feminist, she also uses the S word, socialist, and that this is a play that's as much about capitalism and the question of and class as it is about women in that, mm-hmm. you know, in a business world or women in a situation. And I think those themes are being set forth in a certain kind of way, you know, a less explicit way in that first scene as well.
It almost feels like she's using gender for a political, you know, like she's using gender to talk about socialism in a way.
Hmm. Or vice versa,
yeah.
Or that they're inseparable from each other.
Yeah.
I mean, I think part of what she's showing us is that you can't talk about gender separated from class and other issues, and that what we take in a more conventional realistic play, what we might take to be simply Marlene's choice to leave a child with her sister and it being kind of, you know, tragic and personal and all of that, and this layer is very much there, we read it in another way as well at the same time, is that, you know, even as she's railing against the idea of a social safety net or any kind of support, I mean, we kind of see that she wouldn't have gotten where she's gotten without her sister having stepped in for her. And so I think that both of those things are going on at the same time.
Well, and we were fortunate enough to have Ms. Churchill with us for our first week of rehearsals, and one of the things that she mentioned when she was speaking about how she came to write this piece was that a woman said to her when Margaret Thatcher was elected, said, oh, you know, isn't that great? It's like such a great achievement for feminism. And that she thought to herself, you know, what's the point of, you know, the feminist movement if, you know, this achievement doesn't celebrate and uphold the values that we have been fighting for. So I think that's one of the arguments that's presented in this play.
No, I agree. And I think it's a question that, I mean, I'm asking myself when I'm, you know, on the one hand, very excited and thrilled that we have a woman running, you know, seriously for president, and yet she's talking about obliterating Iran. I mean, it's not exactly a feminist ideal.
Well, and I think it's interesting. I mean, the play feels so timely. We're, it's a play. It was first produced in 1981, and yet, you know, themes of war, themes of, you know, a time of class divide and economic, you know, economic division. And I feel like the play is more contemporary than ever. So
it's still really provocative, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really. People walk out and somebody yelled at us one night.
What did they say?
Oh, you know, awful. I couldn't understand it. It was all the same. You're talking at the same time. That kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's a play that requires something of an audience, and I think, you know, I think that's exciting, but I think when people love this play and people get very frustrated by this play, and I think that's always a good sign. It means something's provocative and it's challenging people.
One of the things, if I can, about the play in the early 80s that I'd forgotten about it, and I felt it very keenly in the top of the second scene, second act today, which is Kitty's nuclear anxiety. You know, I'd completely forgotten that that was an element.
Yes.
And it's very, very powerful and palpable.
No, I was surprised to find that too. I sort of forgotten about the Falklands War.
Yeah.
You know, is that something that was figured into your research at all?
Yeah, well, we spent a lot of time sitting around the table talking, and it's one thing I asked Carol about, and she was talking about, I'm going to get the name wrong, but I think it's called Greenham Common.
Mm-hmm.
That was in England. I wasn't aware of it. But it was before my time. But it was a lot of protests. It was a nuclear site, and outside of London, it was a lot of protests there, and that's what she was referring to. And so it was a huge topic in England at the time, and so it was sort of, you know,
and so there was a women's encampment there.
And I mean, that's, Carol was part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Kitty, so obviously that's Kitty's fixation, is that the world's about to end. So let it be over quickly if it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And she wants to be a nuclear physicist.
Yeah. Figure it all out.
Yeah, that's right. Keep everyone's skin on. So, I'm curious, I mean, we talked a little bit about the overlapping dialogue, which I think you were talking about how in the room it was about orchestration and trying to find the places where, you know, where somebody tops someone else. I'm curious about it as a storytelling gesture, too. I feel like there are all these women who are struggling to be heard, and they're, you know, they're all speaking at the same time. I think there's something very interesting about that. So Do you feel like it informs your motivation as an actress? Like there are times that, you know, it's not just formal, but it's an acting choice as well. When you struggle to be heard, when you fall backwards, how that works in your performance?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's helpful to try to justify those moments, mm-hmm. And acknowledge that someone else is speaking on stage. I think it's helpful for the audience, especially at the beginning, to, you know, it is possible to speak and listen at the same time. It's difficult. And it is possible to hear two different things at the same time. So it is helpful to find some kind of internal motivation. But I don't know. I didn't think about it too much because it is a convention in a lot of her other plays. Mm-hmm. So I didn't give it too much weight.
Well, you guys are doing beautiful work with that and with everything, obviously. Now, these ladies have to do another show, so we're going to let them go, but just want to say, and eat, and so just want to say thank you to the both of you, and then we'll open it up to some questions. Okay. So, if it's all right with you, I thought we would take some questions from you guys. I'm sure you have some questions about what you just saw. Yes, in the baseball hat. And if you could stand and just speak loudly, and I'll repeat your question so everyone can hear it.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out some things. Correct me if I'm wrong. Each of the characters in the first part of the first act had something either taken away from them or gave up something. We're talking here children or a child. And then we have Marlene having to give up something, a child. Am I correct there that that's...
He's talking about the idea of loss, that everybody in the first scene has lost something, often a child, and that Marlene has also lost a child, and just curious if that's something that's intentional. Yeah, I agree. I absolutely feel that the loss of children and the idea that there. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that track through in the first from the first scene. The idea of loss, the idea of, you know, dead lovers, the idea of unhappiness, the lack, inability to find fulfillment. But definitely children. Mm-hmm.
But if I can say, I think for me the suggestion here isn't the. Sort of glossy magazine idea that women have to choose between, you know, families and love lives or careers. I think what Churchill's interested in showing is the social structures that seem to force that that divide. And she wants to, you know, suggest that there needs to be, I mean, not to say that this is like a programmatic kind of play, but I think she's showing us something that's just beyond that sort of typically individualized personal concern and choice, and showing us the social structures that that, you know, weigh so heavily on women and their fulfillment in a variety of simultaneous realms.
I mean, certainly patient Griselda isn't very happy either.
Right.
Yes, in the red. She's asking about the meaning of the last word of the play.
Frightening.
It was almost like The Sopranos. Yeah.
I guess, I mean, for me, that would be a question that I would throw back to everyone.
Exactly.
You know, what feeling are you left with when the last line is frightening? What feels frightening to you about the world that's been demonstrated? And we know, you know, we know what's coming a year later because of the reversal of the scenes. And we know what kind of prospects Angie lacks. A lot of frightening things have been introduced in the course of the play, and I guess it's pretty open-ended.
And I think it's also interesting that she comes out and she calls her Aunt Marlene mother. You know, she calls her, and she, you know, she suspects that she is her mother, and then, you know, I think that that's interesting that that's also part of that final intentionally ambiguous moment as well. Yes.
Suffering and there's no one who can possibly identify with it. I'm wondering if in Churchill's other plays, she presents more of a positive side of what things could be like.
The question is, the play, he suggests that the play indicates a feminist dystopia because no one in the play finds happiness. And in Churchill's other work, does she present a more positive spin on the feminist ideal, I guess?
She's a very, you know, critical. I mean, she's a writer who's interested in critical analysis of our world, and so I think that there's a lot of pleasure and certainly laughter, sure, and enjoyment in the plays at the same time as there's a lot of critical edge, which is a long way of sort of saying no. But I think that there are, you use the word, the phrase identify with, and I think there are moments throughout this play where we're very engaged by and find a kind of identification with the characters. I mean, certainly Marlene's sister, I think, is a very empathic character. At least I feel that way toward her. But I think there's a pivotal scene in the second act where our own sympathies maybe turn, or where they get very complicated, and that's the scene when the wife of the man over whom Marlene's been promoted comes to see her. And at first, I think we're probably cheering for Marlene. We're saying, you know, mm-hmm, why is this wife in Eve? What is she doing? But that her response is so much more than is called for, mm-hmm, that it becomes ugly pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are a lot of occasions in this play where our sympathies ebb and flow, and our sense of identification may be drawn in, and then we're asked to stand back from it and understand something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The question is about the difference between the original production and this production. And actually, there is, it's not exactly the same. There haven't been any textual changes, but there's been a slight order change in terms of the scenes, how the order in which the scenes have been presented. And some of the doubling has changed slightly. So it's not exactly the same.
But. Yeah, I wish I could answer that in detail. I don't remember. I mean, it was 26 years ago. And I don't remember it well enough. I like this one better.
I didn't pay her to say that. Well, that's good news. You know, honestly, I believe, and I may be completely misstating, so I apologize in advance, but I believe that in the original production, the dinner party scene goes into the first scene in the Top Girls. Excuse me. It's a different scene in Suffolk. It goes from the Top Girls agency into the first Suffolk scene with the girls in the little fort. And so this goes directly into the first Top Girls scene in the agency. And that was Carol had written it that way originally, but Max Stafford Clark in the original production had convinced her to switch it. And so in this, she wanted to see it in the way she'd written it. Mm-hmm. The office scene was it was the dinner party, then the office scene in the original production. In this production, it's the dinner party, and then the first scene in Suffolk with the two girls.
Here,
yes. Yes, from her original intent, and so this was a little closer to original intent.
And I think it's also some. I don't remember if this was the case at the Public in the early 80s, but I think it's often done with one intermission instead of two.
Yeah.
Though apparently Churchill prefers it divided this way.
Exactly.
With two.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's
absolutely.
Always open with a dinner party. Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It's clear that these figures have standards, for example, the bachelor's
In that final scene?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. I think we have time for maybe two more questions. So, yes, right here. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as Marlene says, you know, in that amazing last scene, you know, I believe in the individual.
Right. And that necessarily leaves Angie behind.
Right.
I think we've just got time for one more. It was a comment about how each of the women in the dinner party are sort of exceptionalists, and how the dialogue sort of springs out of, you know, because each of them sort of tag teaming off of what the others have said, and the notion of how each of them are exceptionalists, and how perhaps you know, this many years later, feminism hasn't joined forces with socialism, that people still are, you know, looking out for themselves, and some people are doing very well and others not so much.
Well, a certain kind of feminism.
Yes, exactly.
Right? You know, what used to be known as bourgeois feminism.
So, yes, you, go ahead. Sure. The question is, the folks sitting around the dinner table, who were they? And she identified Pope Joan, who Lady Naijo, the sort of the Japanese courtesan and Buddhist monk. But there's Del Gret, who was painted by Bruegel, who took a trip into hell. She's in this amazing painting, dressed exactly as she is in the play, with a big sword, slaying nasty demons. Patient Griselda, who Chaucer wrote about in the Canterbury Tales, who is notable, as you hear in the play, because of the marriage. She was written by Chaucer and Petrarch, and I can't remember who else. Thank you. And is that everyone?
And
Lady Isabella Bird, who was a Victorian traveler at a time when women didn't travel so much. So they were all notable for exceptional choices that they made in their lives. And Patient Griselda made exceptional choices, but more traditional choices. The other women made choices that were perhaps less traditional in terms of their time. And since that was sort of a basic question about who was on stage, maybe we can take one final and finish up. Was there really a Pope Joan? I think there are some questions about that. Yeah, it's not 100% certain about whether or not there was a Pope Joan. And with that, I think we're going to finish up. Thank you so much for coming to be with us.